This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, heard every Saturday morning at 9 on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Welcome, friend, to our weekly garden party. We hope you brought along your questions because it's time to dish the dirt. On The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
Good morning and welcome to The Garden Show. I know I don't sound like Dean. Dean's not here today. He's up to his armpits and alligators, I think is a best way to describe Dean's world today. But I do have a special guest with me who actually knows to dance to our intro music. Welcome, Paul Oliver.
Good morning. I'm great to be back.
Nice to see you and see you virtually because I'm in Prince Edward County. You're in Toronto in your home office.
Yes.
Great. So, and of course, Paul Oliver is the person who started the Urban Nature Store. So he's here with all his knowledge, all his expertise, his tips, his techniques when it comes to urban nature. Of course, birds being something we talk about quite often on this show. It's a big time for birds right now.
It's the big migration season. They're out there and they're feeding like in a frenzy to fatten up for their trips.
Are they ever? We cannot keep our feeders full. It's just, it's wild out there. So we'll certainly talk more about birds. And I hope that some of you out there who, of course, we're happy to hear from for garden questions, urban nature questions, birding, tips, techniques, anything you got going. Paul, why don't you share the numbers with everybody? They can give us a call.
Yes, the phone number for Toronto is 416-360-0740. And outside of Toronto, the toll-free is 866-740-4740.
Wow. I might fire Dean. You're good. You're really good. So, yes, indeed. So please share with us anything you'd like to share. We're happy to talk. In the meantime, I want to share with you some of the announcements that are going on. As you said, Paul, those hort societies are just like those birds. They're back in full form now that it's September. So, by the way, welcome to September. All right, first and foremost, I mentioned last week, the Burlington Horticultural Society is meeting on September the 10th. They have a new location. I mentioned that their speaker is David Stotesbury. He's actually speaking on honey's incredible legacy and the evolution of beekeeping. That's from 6:30 to 9:30. Burlington Hort Society is no longer meeting at the Burlington Senior Center. Instead, they are at the auditorium in the Central Arena at 519 Drury Lane. So, of course, everyone is welcome to that. Also going on Wednesday, September the 10th, is the Riverdale Horticultural Society. They're such an active group. I love them. They do both in-person and virtual meetings. For more information, of course, on how to attend either in-person or virtually, you just send a quick email to info@riverdalehorticultural.ca. It's a 7 p.m. meeting on Wednesday, September 10th. It's a person named Sean Stevens. He's from the Good Day Garlic in Sutton, and he's presenting everything anybody needs to know about growing garlic. So that's very timely. Of course, there's that always busy Agent Court Garden Club. They're doing a show, not so much a meeting, but it's a big flower, vegetable, and design show, Saturday, September the 13th from 2 until 4. Open to the public, free drop-in anytime at the Knox United Education Center, 2575 Midland Avenue. This is where, I mean, they refer to it as kind of a friendly competition, but it's cutthroat. It's really cutthroat. Like what people will do for a red ribbon. I mean, it's like, what? I only got a blue. I wanted a red. So yeah, it's pretty fun just to go to catch all the controversy when the ribbons are being given out. Okay, what else? What have I got here? Just my numbers, I got all mixed up here. All right. So Sunday, September 14th, at the Toronto Botanical Gardens, the Rock Garden and Hardy Plant Society is meeting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. They meet in, I believe, the Floral Hall. And this is going to be an interesting meeting because Peter Keeping, who some of you may know, he's been around breeding clematis for so long, and he's bred some of the most beautiful hardy, you know, Ontario-born clematis at his Bowmanville estate, if you will. He is retiring. He's bringing all his clematis to the show, and he's selling out. He's emptying the greenhouses. So Peter will be there along with some others. There'll be a plant sale going on. And a gentleman named Geir Moen, he's from Norway. He is speaking on alpines. So if any of you are going to the alpines or wishing to make an alpine garden, he's your man. Then there's me. Oh my goodness, this just goes on and on. Monday, September 15th, I'm in the Port Hope Horticultural Society meeting. My topic is designing for shade, 7:30 to 9:30. That evening, we meet at the Parish Hall, 33 Pine Street North. That's the St. John's Church, 33 Pine Street North in Port Hope. And one more is the Toronto, and this is the one Dean always loves. I don't know, Paul, you'll have to tell me if any of these plants kind of grab you, but Dean loves the idea of cacti and succulents. So whenever the Toronto Cactus and Succulent Club is meeting, and in this case, it's a show and a sale on Sunday, September 21st, again, Toronto Botanical Gardens, Floral Hall, 10 until 4. So this is a show, so there's going to be some massive succulents and cacti, plus there's stuff for sale. So you can see some, you can buy like little baby whatevers, but you can see what a mature form looks like because there will be lots of beautiful plants on display at the Toronto Botanical Gardens, Sunday, September 21st, 10 till 4. Sounds like fun. Do you like cacti?
I'm not a big cacti person. I like to see them in shows, but I find that they're a little too much work. And
what? They're the least work of any plant. You get to ignore them.
They just sit there and they just wink at you every once in a while, and that's about it.
I know. Well, but if you're really good, you can get. I've seen, you know, things flat like jade flower as an example.
Yeah.
So you will get, which is always exciting because they're often very fragrant when they do flower, or cacti, some of them start flowering. So that's pretty fun. I mean, you know, boy, listen to you, too much work. Just while I'm thinking about it as well, remember spring bulbs, and we'll talk more about those, I'm sure. But remember, we plant our spring bulbs in the fall for beauty in the spring. There is a website, flowerbulbsareus. That's just like toysareus.com. Caroline DeVries, who runs that website and imports bulbs from Holland and the Netherlands and has the best quality bulbs you'll ever see, like huge, huge bulbs with huge flowers, is offering a 10% off discount to anyone who orders from her site and uses the secret code Charlie. All right, just so you know, and you'll put that in at checkout. So that's all my announcements. We have a minute or two before the break. Should we take a quick call, do you think, Paul?
Sure.
All right. First call is Brad. He's giving us a call from Kincardine. Good morning, Brad.
Good morning, Charlie. How are you today?
Excellent. And you're a first-time caller, and I don't have chime. So ding, 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 ding. There you go. Birds. Oh, the bird calls.
Personal chimes. Nothing Welcome. Better than that. Thank you.
Welcome.
So I
What's
have a,
going on?
I have a well-established fall phlox, and this year, for some reason, all the leaves turned white. And then then they died, and then but the phlox flowered as normal, and I wondered what's going on there and what's the cure for it.
Well, it's interesting. That's kind of the first time you've ever noticed that.
Yes.
On these phlox,
and I've had them for 5+ years, and it's never happened before.
Well, it is called powdery mildew, the white stuff. Looks like somebody literally put some powder on the leaves. Yes. It is a fungal disease. We usually think of it as being a bigger problem in humid summers. Typically, August does tend to have warmth and humidity, partially because of the dew in the evening and sort of just moisture in the air with the temperature changes. So you've obviously got a case of powdery mildew on your phlox. what do you do? Well, there's a couple things you can do. One is move them so they're in absolutely full sun, minimum 6 hours of sun every day. So that's like, you know, wide open plus lots of air circulation. So none of this tucking them into a corner or jamming them in amongst other plants. Lots of air, lots of sun, and you're likely to not see powdery mildew in the future. As well, there are some varieties of powdery mildew cultivars that are resistant to powdery mildew. So sometimes the older varieties, no matter how much we love them, we will eliminate them and bring in some of the newer resistant varieties. One that comes into my brain right now, it's probably the first one that was first ever introduced, is called David. It's a white phlox, garden phlox, that does not produce any mildew on its leaves. So it's nice and clean. So it's an easy one to work with. Thank you. Thank you for the call, Brad. We do have to take a break. Be right back after this.
Fur and feathers and bugs of all size. There's more going on in the garden than you realize. Should small creatures become a big problem, then you've got The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin. Exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
All right, Paul is here as my co-host. There's no Dean, and Paul is an expert in birds and nature that might be something you love and something that frustrates you in the garden, in your property, whether urban or rural, obviously. I want to tell you, Paul, just before we go to a couple of calls that are waiting, standing by, I went on an outing, a birding outing, to Prince Edward Point last Monday, Labor Day Monday. Very interesting. This is not just a jumping off point for so many birds heading south in the fall or heading north in the spring. It's more than that. It's a place where they actually band birds. And it's a national wildlife area. It is a very, there's forest, there's sort of low, shallow water, there's deep water, because it's right on a point that sticks out into Lake Ontario. And I think it's one of the biggest number of birds leave from that point in all of Canada. Have you ever been there?
Yes, I've been there several times. It's a migratory bird mecca down there. And at this time of the year in particular, you're going to see such a wide variety of birds and a lot of birds that aren't indigenous to the area, but are just passing through, stopping in, getting a little fat and food, and then heading out across the lake. Yeah. And the work that they do at there is just, and the volunteers there are just fabulous. It's almost all volunteer work does it. And the banding is so important for us watching the migratory patterns of the birds, but also bird counts when the birds are coming back. Because with global warming and things like that, we're getting the migratory patterns are changing for a lot of birds. So they're going earlier, they're coming later, and it's just a booking nightmare for the airlines trying to book them flying.
I bet. I bet. Well, it was really interesting. So what they do is they have these vertical nets, very, very fine mesh nets that I think they go up 30 feet up into the air and however wide. So they got these different nets. And as you say, volunteers are standing by. As the birds are flying, they hit these nets. It's very soft. There's a lot of give to the net. There's no damage to the birds. But of course, the volunteers have to reach their hands in, grab the little birds off the net. They usually put them in like a little bag just to put them in the dark. And then they take them to the station where there's other people standing by who weigh them and measure them, check if they have a band. If they do, they write them down. If they don't, they band them. And everything is completely, you know, kept track of. Like, it's really quite an operation what they go through. Then they bring them outside and let them go. And we just got to stand there and watch them come out after their ordeal to be let go. But we watched on camera what was going on inside. They don't want too much, you know, distraction. The birds get scared.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's a great, great program. And they probably do some of the highest number of banding there of anywhere in Canada, because they get such a flow of birds through it, the migratory. Yeah. Time and like, but for anyone just going out and at this time of the year, it's bird migration heaven out there, and just going out for bird walks, going out for with the family and going down to places like Tommy Thompson Park in Toronto, which is very close. The number of birds that you'll see there, and if you're really watching, you'll see a lot of birds that from northern Ontario or from the northern areas that we don't normally have here for the summer, but they pop through, visit, say hello, and then away they go head south.
There's a real skill to this though, because I mean, I hear the birds, so that's great, but I don't see them. It's this challenge of seeing them. And I know they, you know, they talk about, you know, seeing with your ears and hearing with your eyes kind of thing. Cause it's when there's a forest and it's leaves in the trees, you're hearing. And of course I have an app on my phone, which is the Merlin app, which helps me identify what this bird might be. So I sort of know what I'm looking for, but you know, typically they're olive green and they're in the top of the treetops. And I'm like, how am I ever going to see that? But it's quite a skill, quite a challenge, but certainly very, very fun.
Yeah. But don't let that be a discouragement to you. As people go out and they do it, they get more familiar with using their ear and their eye to locate the birds. I'm not really good at it, because I get distracted so quickly. The Merlin app, though, is perfect, because it tells me what bird I should be looking for. So it gives you a bit of an idea that they're going to be lower in the tree or up higher, or what the color is to look for. It's great that way.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think it is one of those, you really do have to practice. I mean, it's like anything, right? Yep. Practice makes you so much better. So listen, yep. I know you've got lots going on with your urban nature store, but with groups across Ontario that are doing bird walks. So let's talk about that in a couple of minutes, but maybe we have time for a quick call just to say hello, see what's going on in Dorchester. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Paul and Charlie. I was talking to my son the other day. He knows I listen to your show, and he's unfortunately not able to do it today. So he's got two very large maple trees in his backyard. He's got a 6-foot wooden fence at the north end of his yard, and it creates a lot of shade. And he wants to put in some tall ornamental grass that is likes the shade. Some of the ones that he was looking at, it turned out they need absolutely full sun. So which ones would be good ones that you could suggest? And we're on very sandy soil.
Oof. That's a very tough question. Off the top of my head, there's no tall ornamental grasses that thrive in the shade. I mean, there are some sedges, but sedges are not very tall, and they will handle half day sun, half day shade. One of the ones we all love for part shade is something called Japanese forest grass, or also known as Hakka Kloa. But again, it's not tall. It's a kind of a floppy, beautiful grass. He wants height in the shade. First off, suggest to him maybe pull in an arborist, thin the crown of the tree so a little bit more light can come through, because maples tend to be very, very dense and it's dark, dark shade and nothing grows beneath them. And then look at shade tolerant plants, look at hostas, look at rhododendrons, look at, oh gosh, there's a whole bunch of things that do very well in spreading hemlocks. I mean, there's tons of low shade tolerant things, you know, trilliums, lily of the valley, though I wouldn't recommend planting it, but tall grasses. I'll wrap my head around that, Diane, see if I can come up with anything, but at this point I have no great suggestions for tall shade grasses.
I totally agree with you, because everything I looked at, it said shade, and then it contradicted itself, and it needs at least 4 or 5 hours of sun.
Right. That is not shade.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Thanks, Diane. Well, I'll let you know if I come up with anything. All right. We need to just, Paul, stand by. Paul's here with me from the Urban Nature Store. And of course, we're here to talk about anything that's going on in your gardens, whether it's in the ground or flying around in the trees. Coming back right after this.
Daffodils and daisies, bluebells and begonias, forsythia and foxgloves, marigolds, magnolia, lavender and lupins, dahlias, delphiniums, stocks, fox, hollyhocks, tulips and sweet williams.
You've picked the right place for everything floral. This is The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
not just floral, but also wild. We're all about wild today. I've got Paul Oliver in studio. Not really. He's in his studio in Toronto, and I'm in my studio in Prince Edward County. And we're here not only talking about phlox and Sweet William, but also bird migration, bird support. So, Paul, before we get into a little bit more about birds, can you just share the phone numbers for anybody who'd like to call in?
Yes, for callers in Toronto, the phone number is 416-360-0740. And if you're outside of Toronto, it's 866-740-4740. And looking forward to any of those birding calls.
That's right. Or squirrel calls or possum calls. What about possums as well? Coyotes. But I know you're involved. You sponsor some bird walks, do you not, at this time of year?
Yes. Yeah. So we're really working to get new to birding people out to feel comfortable going and doing that, spotting the birds, seeing the birds, hearing the birds. So we do a fair number of walks. We've got actually one going on right this morning in High Park with Alex from our Hamilton store. We have several coming up. We've got one October 4th in Mississauga at the Riverwood Conservancy. And shout out to the team there. They do a fabulous job in nature related. We've got a couple in Toronto, October 11th, October 14th. And then we also have our annual one that we do with Julia Zarankin at Lynn Shores on October 19th. That's always a hugely popular one.
Because she's an author.
She's an author. She's very knowledgeable. And it's her and Martha do it together. And Martha's a nature photographer. And Martha can spot those birds at 100 miles away. And she has that talent.
And of course, binoculars are a handy thing to have when you're out and about.
Yeah. And one of the things we started this year was actually a binocular sharing program. So even if you don't have binoculars, come to the event. We normally have a dozen or so that we can lend out during the walk. And the other thing we've started doing now is for community groups that are doing their own walks, they can actually borrow the binocular sets and share them with their participants and then drop them back to one of our local stores. Because what we really want is particular kids or younger, newer to birding people to get to use the binoculars the first time, see what they like about them, what they don't like, whether they're too heavy, too small. And a lot of it with binoculars, it's using, touching, and feeling them. You can't really get an idea about binoculars when they're online and they're shipped to you from hundreds of miles away.
Yeah, right. You got to wear them on your body. Like, you have to have them with you. I mean, a serious birder hardly gets out of bed without putting their binoculars on, right?
Yes.
The dates and locations you mentioned, those would be all on your website, I assume.
Yes, they are. All the information about the walks, and we may be adding a few more to augment that depending on participation in that. So,
okay. And your website is?
UrbanNatureStore.ca.
There you go. So lots on there. I mean, certainly things to buy, you know, food for these birds that need to be fattened up before winter, all that important stuff is there, right?
Yes, and keeping those feeders filled at this time with that super fatty food, sunflower hearts, things like suet, getting it out earlier, the birds will go crazy. They'll thank you for that. They're not going to Jenny Craig. They don't care. They want to be as big as possible before they head south. And even for the overwintering birds, they're storing up food. They're storing up energy. So.
Absolutely right. And the peanuts, we go through peanuts here like crazy. The blue jays just... they're nonstop. And of course, everybody's fighting for them sometimes. Mealworms, even.
Yes.
Protein.
Yeah. Give them that extra protein. They'll thank you for everything you put out in the
Nice. All right. Well, let's see. We've got a few callers on the line. Let's see if we've got what's happening in Scarborough. Elizabeth's standing by. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning. I inherited two very large hibiscus plants, a beautiful rose. It's just a mass of blooms and a yellowy orange one. But, you know, I'm going to have to bring them in soon. And they're, you know, like 3-4 feet across. So I'm wondering, I'd like to make some new plants. And at the very tip, there's only about 2 inches of new growth. And on that new growth, there's a bud. So I hate to sort of cut it off, and so I do want to make, you know, a new plant. and about cutting it back, or what do I do to bring, so I can bring it in?
Okay, so that it is a bit of a challenge at this time of year, what you're experiencing. So you're right, you do need that soft, flexible new growth to get roots to grow as quickly as possible. You
yes.
can get, take a longer cutting, which would include some of the stiffer, barkier growth, which would be considered a, not really a hardwood cutting, but it is not a softwood cutting. It's
kind of in
between. At this time of year, it is slow to get roots to grow from cuttings, just because the days are getting shorter, plants are responding to that and hunkering down for winter. So you won't find, like back in June, you could have taken some short cuttings and had roots within a few weeks. Now it might take a few months to get roots. So still worth a try, because you just don't want to, you know, risk losing these plants. They sound quite beautiful. The colors are very unusual.
They're absolutely. And my friend went into a senior's residence, so of course she couldn't take these. They were outside in her yard, and I had trouble even getting them into the trunk of my car because they're so massive.
Wow.
But I couldn't let them just go to.
No.
So you think
that
very hard, nubby growth would eventually, if I put rooting compound on it, do you think that would help?
Yes, definitely it helps. Rooting compound is a stimulating, stimulates root growth. It is a hormone. It's a little powder hormone.
Yeah.
So yes,
would it grow
that is definitely.
Would I put it into soil or into water?
You could do either.
The
hibiscus, usually we just root them in water because they root so quickly and we can see when we've got roots. As soon as we've got a bit
of
root, then get them into soil. No, but they will root eventually, as long as you keep that water clean. Every now and then you're going to have to just give it a change and change it up, scrub out the jar and get them back. Put them in the sun, of course, sunny window ledge. You do want them in bright areas. The big plants, it's too bad your friend couldn't have taken them to the senior's residence. When my dad went into a residence, we took his big hibiscus with the same idea and donated it to the facility, and they put it in their, they have a big sunny solarium, so they put it there. So it wasn't, he didn't have to be responsible for it. They were.
And then
everybody got the benefit of it. So it's, it is a challenge for now. Yes. To try and save those plants. I know you're gonna have to cut off all those buds, shrink those plants down by no more than a third, and then bring them in before frost. And give them a good thorough wash before you do that. So, you know, good hose, blow off all the spiders and whatever else is on them before you bring them in.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Right.
Good luck with that, Elizabeth. Thank you. Thanks for your call. Yeah. So that's, boy, hibiscus. And I know, Paul, I won't ask you about hibiscus because you're going to go, oh, too much work. I used to do this show with a guy named Frank Proctor. I'm not sure if you ever met him before.
Frank. Yes.
Yeah, you met Frank. Yeah, he always claimed that he could even kill fake plants. Like, he could kill anything. It was his specialty, killing plants. So just to bug him, I'd give him a plant for his birthday every year just to so he could kill it. Let's just talk briefly about this book I'm holding up for you to see that I know you sell at your store. Didn't you see it?
Oh, yes. Yvonne buys a book about Look What Flew Through the County. It's her first book. Yeah. She did it with a couple of the volunteers from the Prince Edward Point bird volunteers. They're both excellent. Photography in it is excellent.
Crazy beautiful.
It's Yvonne's very first book. She retired. So when she was retiring, she went on to go take up birding and writing books. And she's
photography.
She does a thousand different volunteer things in the Prince Edward County. She's a phenomenally busy woman. She got this book out. Hopefully she'll do another book to follow on this. But this one actually, it's specifically for the Prince Edward County, but it covers all of Southern Ontario. So the birds that they focus on. So whether you're in Kingston or you're in Essex County, it's going to be a great book for that. And I love it when it's someone that takes up birding, gets inspired by birding, and then becomes an author or takes it to the next step. It's just amazing.
And to the next level. It's a very beautiful book. It's a soft cover. It's thick. It's like hundreds of pages long. great photography, lovely index at the back. Yvonne, as you mentioned, is new to birding, but her two backup authors are Terry Sprague, who's very well known here as an environmentalist, and David Bree. So they are, it's everything from owls to water birds to songbirds, like, and everything in between. It's a lovely, lovely book. So if you have somebody on your Christmas or birthday list who is considering getting into birding, this is an excellent choice. And you do sell it at the Urban Nature Store.
Yes, we do. Yes.
Yeah. It's a great book.
Yeah, they can even see the book online. We sell it online as well at urbannaturestore.ca. So if they're not close to a store, they can at least get a bit of the information about the book.
Sweet. All right, let's see what's going on in Utah. Oh, no, sorry, Mary. Mary in Toronto. Good morning, Mary.
Yeah, good morning. I was planting some garlic for the last couple of years, but they're just tiny little bulbs on it. Never have a big bulb on it.
Okay.
I don't know.
So, and the
soil, it's like clay. I put some peat moss in, but I guess not enough.
Okay. So you're right. All right. The clay soil will not grow any bulb well. It is too damp for too long because it doesn't drain very well. You need to get some organic matter, not just peat moss, but maybe a couple of bags of composted manure. I'm a big fan of leaves. The leaves are starting to drop off the trees. Incorporating or just laying leaves on top of your clay soil will very much improve the quality of that soil. In terms of growing great garlic, it's like anything. You won't get great plants unless you start with a great plant. So don't be planting little squidgy, tiny garlic cloves. Perhaps you need to attend the event that is being put on by the Riverdale Hort Society, Sean Stevens from the Good Day Garlic Farm in Sutton. You need to get a hold of some better garlic, maybe even just your local farmer's market. You will find big cloves of garlic. Don't plant little squidgy ones. Plant big ones. You're more likely to get an excellent big bulb next year. Of course, we are going to be planting our garlic sort of not so much now, but in the next few weeks. I tend to wait till October to get my garlic in the ground. But and improving your soil will always improve your crop. So Mary, do that first before you plant anything. Clay soil, not so good. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. Let's see. We can just now go off to Utah and see what's going on at Leo's place. Good morning, Leo.
Good morning, Charlie. How are you?
Excellent.
Okay, great. I've got some beautiful maple trees in my backyard. One of them is about 40 foot tall. And, of course, fall is coming and the leaves are turning and the edges are getting brown and they're not turning into color. But I right. noticed that they had some white little spots, like kind of like powdery spots. I'm wondering if that's a bad sign and if I need to do something really quick because I don't want to lose my tree. What do you
think? No, of course. Okay, so this is actually a very timely question. A good question, Leo. At this time of year, when you have deciduous plants, so plants that are going to drop their leaves, maples are a good example, that have leaves that don't look quite perfect. They have spots on them. They have funny little bumps on them. They have strange either white spots, black spots, anything like that. Do not worry because these leaves are going to drop. And next year is a whole new year. The plants have had all summer to photosynthesize, to absorb lots of, you know, lots of energy from the sun and produce lots of carbohydrates. So they're going into the winter, you know, in good condition. Next year, all new leaves. With maples, it depends on the kind of maple. Maples in general tend to be very dense, as we mentioned earlier. They grow a lot of branches and twigs and big leaves and dark, dark, dark beneath, and not a lot of great air circulation. So as our maples get older, always a nice idea to have an arborist, a certified arborist in your back pocket who can come in every 3-4 years and just do a little bit of a thinning of that tree. So removing some of the inside growth to allow better air, better sun, you'll have fewer mildew problems. And then the next question is, well, what about those leaves that fall? If they do have fungal diseases, et cetera, should I send them away or should I keep them on the property? And that is a great philosophical question that only you can answer. I tend to just keep the leaves on my property. I don't send them away, but some people prefer to not keep the potential disease making leaves on the property. So kind of, you know, up to you, Leo, but don't worry, your tree's going to be absolutely fine next year. And in the meantime, I just got to get through this winter.
This is awesome.
Thank you.
I was getting worried about my tree, and this is good news. Thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Yeah, don't worry about trees, deciduous trees at this point. If we're going to worry about anything, we're going to worry about our evergreens, but we can talk more about that when we get back right after this.
Don't change stations just because the weather changes. Garden tips and advice all year round. This is The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
That's Charlie Dobbin and special co-host Paul Oliver today. Paul, we had a call in. The person didn't stay on the line, but the question was something to do with pumpkin seeds. I guess that's the idea is that you carve a jack-o'-lantern and you pull all that goop out and seeds out. And can we then put those out into the yard? I mean, obviously it's all organic, but will those seeds be good quality coming out of a pumpkin for wildlife?
Yeah, pumpkin seeds are a great food for birds and wildlife. They're high fat and they're also very high in protein. So they're getting both out of it. The one drawback with pumpkin seeds is if you're buying them, they're expensive as a seed for birds. But the other drawback with them is they're a fairly thick shell on the seed. Blue jays will love them. They go crazy over them. Cardinals go crazy over them because they can easily open it. The smaller birds have trouble opening the seeds. So if you're putting out deshelled pumpkin seeds, they're great for them. But if you've got a lot of pumpkin seeds and that are in the shell and you want to still put them out for the smaller birds like the chickadees and the finches, just put them in a food processor, break them up a little bit, and then they'll be able to sort through between the shell, pick through the shell and get the meats out of it.
Yeah, and I guess a tray feeder would be the best, or just straight on the ground.
Yeah, on the ground, or even, a tray feeder or fly-through feeder that has the larger opening area for them. And you don't need to roast them or anything. Just let them dry and put them out. You can roast them, lightly roast them, but the birds, they'll get a bit more nutritional value out of the raw ones, which they're used to in a natural environment.
Well, plus there's a little moisture in them. In my neighborhood, we've been hurting for precipitation here in the county. It is a cloudy day today. The lawns have greened up because we have had some since we last did the show, we've had two different rainfalls, neither of which was huge. They were, 12, 14 kind of millimeters. Oh, maybe one was a tiny bit more, like 20. So yes, lawns have greened up. Shallow rooted things are a lot happier, but trees are not. They're still very, very dry. And the wildlife is clearly very thirsty around here. I've got a tomato hanging on one of my tomato plants, which every night some little critter takes bites out of. And I love this critter because it keeps going to the same tomato, which is great.
Oh, they're not just that's a good guess.
No kidding. Not taking a bite out of every tomato. So I've left the tomato hanging there. And I don't know, it's low to the ground. So it could be a raccoon, could be a bunny rabbit. Like it's something that's only, a foot tall kind of thing. But yeah, they're thirsty. My bird baths are the number one destination. Even the big crows are bathing in the bird bath.
Yeah, and at migratory period time, the water bird baths can be a huge magnet for the migratory birds. So I really encourage people, if they haven't been using bird baths up to this point, make sure that they are filled. Or if they don't have a bird bath, just put a bowl of water, a shallow bowl of water out in the morning for the birds, and they'll use it. Not so much for drinking, not so much for bathing, but for the drinking particular, hydrating before they start off their migratory path.
Yeah, exactly. Because all these seeds are pretty dry. And of course, I would never give pumpkin seeds to birds because I eat them.
Yes.
when I scrape out the pumpkin, it's for me. And I roast them for me, not for the birds. So a bird bath is almost like a mirror. Like the birds can see the bird bath and they will come in and happily bathe. Now, bird baths got a really bad rap during the initial West Nile virus fears for this because of the standing water idea and mosquitoes and larva and West Nile virus. So what do you recommend to people if they have a bird bath to keep it clean?
The little solar fountains are great for just keeping the water moving. What you're doing is just a little bit of movement of the water, be it a fountain or a water wiggler or anything that keeps the water moving, then the mosquitoes won't use it for their larva. They won't go into anything that's moving, but if you have a little bit of the movement of the water, I can guarantee you, you'll probably get four times as many birds because they actually see the movement from afar and then they come down and explore and find out it's the water they're looking for. So a little bit of ripples and that keeps the mosquitoes away, and a little bit of ripples draws even more birds in.
Of course, then the big birds are the bullies and they scare away the little birds, and the little birds have to wait for the big birds to have their bath and then they can come in. But there's a bit of a lineup with little towel racks and lockers in my backyard because they wait, right? Big birds always take the first go. So listen, let's see what's going on. Speaking of urban wildlife, Nick is calling from Toronto. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. How are you?
Excellent. What's happening at your place?
That's good. I have a question regarding raccoons and grapes.
Hmm.
Yeah, I have a grape plant, and I never get a chance to eat the grapes. The raccoons, they just start going away, and they leave me nothing. So is there anything that I can do to control them? Not stop them, but just control them where I can get a chance to eat my grapes, because I never get a chance to eat my grapes. And then, of course, the birds come in and the squirrels come in, and then I got nothing. But they're the main culprit.
So tell me where the grapes are growing. Are they on a trellis or an arbor or a gazebo?
Okay, fence? So I have the garage and I have a fence. And on the near the fence, they're growing, and then they go right in front of the garage.
Okay, so they're using that vertical surface.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've got a couple of suggestions here that I found online, but Paul, with more experience, might have some suggestions as well.
Yeah, with them being at different levels or that with different access points for the raccoons to get at them, it's a bit more challenging than if they were freestanding in a middle of the yard or something. For the birds, putting on some of that reflective tape that just hangs down, flutters around, scares the birds away, often helps from them from that perspective. And some people find that if they use that Swedish product, plant skid, and they spray it on the ground around the plant that they're protecting and back a little bit, what it does is it's not harmful for the raccoon, but it tricks them into thinking it's a kill zone or an unsafe area to go. And particularly the younger raccoons will stay away from it that way. And so a lot of people sort of create a little barrier around their vegetable gardens or the grapes or that with the plant skids so that it becomes a no entry zone for them. It works fairly well. It's sold in a liquid form in Canada. And what a lot of people do is they'll put some mulch on the ground, spray it on that so the mulch is actually holding the smell, and then it'll last about 4 to 6 weeks before it needs to be refreshed. But with raccoons, because they are very inventive and they'll do a lot of stuff that people never expect, they are one of the hardest animals to control when it's food involved, because they can race in, grab a few grapes and disappear, and it doesn't, they don't get that risk factor that they would in some other settings, but.
They're wily. Yeah, so it's physical barriers, it's chemical sprays, it's electric fences. You know, that's basically what you're going to end up doing. A dog will often scare away a raccoon. There's not for very long. I mean, if it's a good dog, it'll keep the raccoons at bay, but still.
I can rent out my chihuahua by the hour to protect the grape vines.
There you go.
But then again, she may end up trying to eat them as well. She eats everything. Yeah. So.
And she's a tiny but fierce.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks,
Paul. Thank you so much. For, you guys have a great day.
Yeah, you too. All right. We do need to take our final break. We'll be right back after this.
Fur and feathers and bugs of all size. There's more going on in the garden than you realize. Should small creatures become a big problem, then you've got The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin. Exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
Okay, it's not only Charlie Dobbin, but remember, I've got Paul Oliver with me in our separate studios in different parts of the province, but he's here with all kinds of great ideas, and he represents, the Urban Nature Store. So we'll just finish the show with some tips and tricks from Paul, but we've got one final caller on the line, Diane, returning on the show from Dorchester. Good morning, Diane, again.
Good morning, yes. Charlie, I usually wait till the first frost, and then, you know, the stems that grow up in the middle of your hostas, I usually cut them down at that time. But is it too early if I cut those stems off? And I know you cautioned us all not to cut them to the ground or remove them completely because you said some little insects can get inside and survive over for the winter. And the same with the peonies. Should the peonies, though, I just wait until the frost, or can I do them now too?
If you can wait till the frost, I would. Sometimes you can't because you've got, you know, you're taking a cruise to France or something, so then you have to get out and deal with some of the gardens before
you regularly
wish. Would.
Yeah.
What I like about a frost, Diane, is that the cold frost, like a real frost, not a little, you know, 0 degrees, but like a -3 kind of frost, that is what truly shuts the plants down. So physiologically, they are down for the winter. And whatever you do at that point has absolutely no impact. They're not going to start growing back. We start trimming any of our plants now, mild September weather, we actually encourage more growth. And we do not want to encourage more growth. Winter's coming. So we want to let the plants naturally shut down. And the best way to do that is don't prune them if you can avoid it and wait until a good hard frost and then do what you wish. But your point is a good one. When we are cutting down herbaceous plants, particularly grasses, peonies, any of it, remember, try and leave at least lay all that material somewhere on your property so that if there are insects in there, they can survive. Don't bag it and send it off, you know, to the landfill or to the yard waste people. Keep it on the property if you can, or just drop it right down where you cut it from on the surface of the soil and let it'll just, again, release good moisture, some nutrients as it decomposes slowly, and you do your real cleanup next spring. All right.
Thank you. Thank you so very much, because I really would have hated to harm my plants by, you know, getting them growing again and then the frost comes along and they could have been damaged. So, no, that's why I think all of our the listeners that you have appreciate all the advice you give us. And you're like a walking encyclopedia. Thank you very much. Okay, have a good day and enjoy your weekend. And thanks, Paul. I don't have a bird question today, but I am listening to everything you're saying. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Diane. Appreciate it. Yeah, we're just both of us. We're just full of all kinds of ideas here. So, all right. So let's say, what are the most important things we should remember as winter comes to our gardens? What do birds need?
Oh, leaving out a lot of the leaves so that insects are there. There's a safe area for them to hide out and roost in. I also encourage people, if they've got bird houses, clean the birdhouse out, take some of the long grass, ball it up, put it inside there so that they can use it as a roosting house during the winter. They'll pop in, hang out when the weather is bad, and rest up leaving out a lot of the foliage, and don't prune it back anything that has seeds on it.
Right.
Leave the seeds there because the birds will continue to eat those through the winter.
Sure, it could be even, sorry to interrupt, but something as simple as a roses, like my roses have hips on them, little fruits. Yes. Mm-hmm. So of course, I don't cut those back because the birds will eat them.
Yes. Yeah. And it's a great, because the birds still rely about 80 to 85% of their food as natural food sources, even when we're assisting them with human assisted food. So those natural food sources mixed with what we're putting in the feeder is just helps balance out their diet and that. And the birds, one question I often get is how long to keep my hummingbird feeder out if I leave it out and it encourages them to stay longer. It doesn't. They actually are dictated by the amount of sunlight that we're getting as to when they start their migration. They'll do that at their appropriate time. Taking the food away from him at the last, before he leaves, doesn't help him. So I tell people to keep their feeder, hummingbird feeder out until about 2 weeks after they last see one of the guys around. Wow.
All right. Good points. And keep them clean. Keep them fresh.
Keep them clean. Boy. Keep them fresh and keep it fresh.
Yeah, those hummingbirds, man, they're in my face. Clean my feeder. Okay, yeah. I'm on it. Thank you, Paul. Really, really appreciate you sharing this hour with me today.
I'm always happy to be here.
And the listeners love you being here as well. So check out urbannaturestore.ca for more information. Until then, see you all again next week.
This has been an exclusive podcast of The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin. Heard every Saturday morning at 9 on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.